Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast. To search for other podcasts you might like, click bbc.co.uk/5live,
where you'll also find our terms of use.
Today we are broadcasting live from an animal research laboratory in Oxford. It's the first time, as far as we know, any lab like this has allowed a programme to witness live the kind of work that goes on here. Right this second, we are in the micro-injection laboratory. It's quiet, it's warm. It has a sort of vaguely sterile smell, but certainly nothing unpleasant. And there are various micro-injectionists sitting in front of us doing their work, which we will describe in a second. The reason that we're here is to look at some of the research that's taking place using thousands and thousands and thousands of mice, research which scientists hope will help reveal how and why we, as human beings, get conditions like Alzheimer's and diabetes. This is not a place where scientists test new drugs on mice. This is where scientists create their own mice, and we'll explain how in a second. The mice they create have had their genes altered to give them diabetes or Alzheimer's or to make them obese. So they are, in fact, genetically modified mice. And researchers hope that if they can ultimately identify the genes which cause, say, diabetes, they will be able to work towards new therapies and treatments. But it's a very, very slow process and can take decades. So on the programme this morning, we're going to look at that process, how genetically altered mice are created. We're going to look at some of the different tests that take place on the mice here. Throughout the whole programme, we'll be asking why, of course, and later we'll hear from those opposed to using mice in this way. But first, a couple of facts. The genetic makeup of mice and men is very, very similar. Humans have around 20,000 genes, and so do mice. And 99% of our genes are exactly the same, which is obviously why mice are so useful, scientists say, for their work. The latest Home Office figures show that nearly 3,700,000 animals were experimented on in UK labs in 2011. Of those, nearly 2,700,000 were mice. The remaining million were mainly other rodents, birds and fish, although 153 cats, nearly 3,000 dogs and about 1,500 monkeys were also used. Animal rights campaigners say not only is any form of animal testing morally indefensible, it's also unnecessary and with questionable results. Around 50,000 mice are kept here at the Mary Lyon Centre, which is part of the International Centre for Mouse Genetics, run by the Medical Research Council on the outskirts of Oxford. Every week, between 2,000 and 2,500 of the mice are killed, the vast majority by having their necks broken. Scientists here say that process is quick and painless, but some are anaesthetised, and that process can take up to a minute before they die. It's worth just describing what we have to wear to get into this place. Clearly, it's a very sterile environment. Well, we've had to go through strict security. We've had to strip to our underwear, put on loose tunics and trousers. Over that, we have a navy blue boiler suit and a hairnet before then going through a dry shower. And all our radio equipment has had to be sterilised and screened 48 hours in advance. Now, Professor Steve Brown is one of the directors of the Mary Lyon Centre, which is funded by you, the taxpayer, and has an annual budget of around £15 million a year. Professor Brown, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Thank you for having us here. Tell us why you have given us permission to be here.
Well, it's really to talk about the importance of the research that we're doing. As you've already alluded to, the biggest challenge for medicine in the 21st century is to understand the relationship between genes and disease. We know most diseases have a very large genetic component, but we know perilously little about what those genes do and how they cause disease. And the humble mouse that we work on here is our avenue. It's our route. It's the most powerful route to find out that answer.
And how do you view the mice that you use here?
We view them with compassion and care. They're our partners in this great endeavour to try and bring better healthcare, not just to humans, but also to animals as well. The discoveries that we make here will help not only human healthcare, but animal healthcare as well.
So explain how the kind of work you do with mice genes will help your understanding, our understanding of human conditions like Alzheimer's or obesity.
Well, as I said, we know that genes are critical for the development of disease. When something goes wrong with a gene, it gives us some sort of disease. We know, as you've already said in your intro, that there are 20,000 human genes, but we know very little about what each of those individual genes do. And what we can do in the mouse is that we can alter each of those genes one by one and ask, what is the outcome for the mouse? If we alter gene X, does it get diabetes? If we alter gene Y, does it get Alzheimer's disease? So finding out that complex relationship between our genes and disease will ultimately help us understand the mechanisms of disease. And through that, of course, we're in a position to develop better therapies and better drugs.
So you're trying to, using mice genes, identify, for example, the obesity gene or the diabetes gene or genes?
There's never one gene for these diseases. That's the complexity of the situation. For obesity or diabetes, there will be potentially hundreds of genes. For most diseases, cancer, etc., there will be hundreds of genes. We need to understand each of the genes that is contributing to those diseases and their interactions, the complexity of how we as a mammalian organism work and how when genes go wrong, they cause disease.
You say you view the mice here with compassion, yet you do all sorts of things to them, which we'll discuss throughout the program today, some of which may be potentially painful or stressful, and you also kill 2,500 of them every week. How is that compassionate?
But our primary role as researchers is to look after the welfare of the mice. Clearly, we are doing experiments on mice. We have to do that. But in doing it, and it's enshrined in law, we must minimize pain and suffering. We must make sure at all times we adhere to the highest standards of welfare. So, of course, we're carrying out experiments, but we're aiming to do them in the most compassionate and the most non-invasive way that we can to find out these key facts.
And when we describe what goes on here today, some of the things that we will see here today, we will hopefully listeners will make up their own minds as to whether they believe it to be compassionate or not. And we're inviting them to talk to you a little later on in the program, which listeners are very welcome to do. 0500 909 693. Who decides what the centre's priorities should be? Who's decided, for example, to look at ageing and Alzheimer's and diabetes and obesity?
It's decided partly by the Medical Research Council. They have a strategy in terms of delivering better healthcare to the population in the UK. And clearly, they want us to focus on areas where there's the most urgent need for new treatments. Of course, to take, for example, aging, we know that diseases related to aging are increasing very rapidly in our population. We need to be able to better understand the genes that are involved in those aging processes. So the strategy is set at a very high level for the UK. And obviously, we respond by taking on that strategy and using our own scientific insight to develop particular projects, particular scientific angles, particular scientific discoveries that we think will give us most insight into those particular areas.
Tell our listeners about the work you've done on glue ear in children. What is glue ear, first of all?
Well, glue ear is a very common condition in children. In fact, many of the listeners out there, I'm sure, will have children currently or suffering from glue ear. It's basically where the middle ear, which transmits the sound from outside to the inner ear, becomes full of pus and fluid. And in fact, it's the commonest cause of hearing loss in children. And also, it's the commonest reason for surgery in children. The only current treatment for chronic glue ear in children is to insert a little tube, it's called a grommet, into the tympanic membrane, ostensibly to relieve pressure and fluid from inside the middle ear.
And to insert that, the child has to undergo
a general anaesthetic. Yeah. It's obviously a very invasive treatment. Now, what we've done at Harwell is we've developed mouse models of glue ear who have the same chronic condition. They have this pus and fluid in their middle ear that prevents them from hearing. But by studying those mice, studying the genes that have caused them to have this glue ear, we're now beginning to understand the molecular mechanisms, the real mechanisms of why do kids actually get glue ear. So now we're going in with potential new treatments to actually treat the cause of glue ear at source. Actually, what's going wrong with these children? And at the moment, we're developing new treatments, which I hope will go into clinical trials in the next few years. So we'll be able to change the whole approach to therapy for glue ear. No longer invasive surgery, but rather potentially going to your GP, a patch is put on the tympanic membrane, the drug filters through into the middle ear and clears up the condition. That's the way a simple experiment on mice identifying that new relationship between a gene and disease can translate into extraordinary new developments in therapies that will help our population at large.
How many years have you been working on that?
We've been working on the glue ear mouse for about 10 years. So we made an enormous...
Why does it take so long?
Well, science doesn't necessarily go at a galloping pace. We can't always stampede towards the outcome. Sometimes we've got to really look in detail, work out exactly what's happening at the level of the cell within the ear, at the level of the DNA. So it's careful, cautious, but ultimately leading to a treatment that will transform our approach to this particular disease.
Jim in Derby says, do experiments on mice actually work? They are mice and not human, right? Where is the science to validate the method? We are not getting any fast results, so maybe they are bogus methods.
Mice are mammals just like humans. Their physiology, their biochemistry is extraordinarily similar. So although we're rather big and we don't have much hair, and mice are small and rather furry, inside we work very much the same. We know this from all sorts of disease states, that the mechanisms, the underlying genes, are the same. We have a number of ways of checking the way our experiments are working with what's happening in the human population. To give the example of glue ear, we're looking at the fluids in children who are affected by glue ear as well and comparing it with our results in mice. And that gives us confidence that we're working on a system that can really tell us what's happening in the human population.
Why couldn't you do the same testing on children with glue ear as opposed to on mice first?
Too dangerous. Too many risks involved. The great advantage of our work in mice is that we can move forward with drugs where we already have a realistic understanding and a realistic expectation that they're going to work in humans. Any other approach, directly testing in humans, would be a lottery and fraught with dangers. That would be bad science.
You're publicly funded, as I said in the introduction, an annual budget of around £15 million a year. Your salary of £115,000 a year comes out of the public purse, clearly. Do you get other funding from drug companies or charities?
We work with a whole lot of agencies, both charities and also drug companies, because it's important that we take advantage of all the skills in the UK, not only within charities but within pharmaceutical companies, to bring to bear both information, science, potential new drugs that we can use to investigate the systems that we're working on.
Is it likely that you will discover cures, or much more likely that you'll discover relevant therapies and treatments?
We're in the business here of, first and foremost, understanding the mechanisms. How do genes cause disease? And through that, we'll get information about potential routes to therapies. And where we can, we're working with charities, with other organizations, with pharmaceutical companies to actually take those through preclinical studies to clinical studies, closer to actually trying out new treatments in the human population. Glue ear is a good example. I think we're much closer to having what you might call a cure for glue ear rather than just a surgical intervention which alleviates it. And that has to be the goal of all clinicians, of all biomedical scientists.
When people imagine any sort of animal testing, any animal research, they imagine protesters outside with placards and banners and so on and staff, sometimes in fear for their own safety. You don't get protesters here.
No, we don't, but as we're doing with this program, we need to talk to the public, we need to tell them what we're doing, why we're doing it, why it's important, and we'll talk to anybody about that. That's very important for us. We clearly receive public funding for the work that we do here, as you mentioned, and it's important for us to ensure that the public at large know the aims of our work and what fruits for human health and healthcare can come from it.
Thank you for the moment. It's Professor Steve Brown, one of the directors here at the Mary Lyon Centre. The centre itself is about the size of a big supermarket. We've got six different wards here. That's what they're called. That's where the mice are kept. Throughout the programme, we're going to drop in on some of those wards, including the experimental and behavioural ward. Right now, though, as I said a little earlier, we're in what's called the micro-injection laboratory, and it's effectively where mice are created. At this moment, technicians are currently injecting modified cells, altered cells, mutant cells, you could call them, into an embryo. And that embryo will be implanted into a female mouse. Tony is one of those technicians, 33 years of age, has worked here for the last 15 years. Hello, Tony. How are
Hello.
You?
Hello. Yeah, good, thank you.
One of the micro-injectionists here, as I said. You'd rather we didn't use your surname, which we're perfectly happy to comply with, if you like. But explain to our listeners why.
Just because I think a lot of people out there have a bad perception of people that work in medical research, work testing on animals. I just think it's because they don't actually realise what actually goes on inside. They have this big image that they see of posters advertised, and they don't actually know what really goes on.
Tell us what really goes on right in front of you now. We've got a huge microscope here.
I've got a huge microscope. I've got computer joysticks, they look like.
For your left hand and for your right hand on either side of the microscope.
I've got, and one controls my needle, which picks up my cells. One controls my holding pipette, which picks up my embryo.
And you're putting the cells
into the
embryo. And
I'm putting the cells into the embryo.
And what kind of cells are these?
These are embryonic stem cells. They're for diabetes research.
Okay, so you're effectively, if I can put it in this kind of language, putting diabetes cells into an embryo, which will then be implanted into a mouse.
Yeah. So I'm creating a genetically modified mouse that will then go on and be used in research for diabetes.
Okay. Do you want to go ahead and do that?
The
way we are watching this is obviously on a big computer screen. Tony herself is looking down the lenses of the microscope, and the embryo is in front of her on a small round piece of glass. She's using her right hand to move the right joystick, which controls one of the pipettes in which the diabetes cells are. And we're watching this on a computer screen, so we can see the pipette draw up the cells, and I think she's about...
I've just injected that one.
Sorry, I missed that.
The cells have just gone in. So, yeah, I will show you now. I'll just release that one. I'll pick up some cells and then inject them into the embryo.
Okay. So she's picking up the cells now with the right-hand pipette and moving it towards the embryo. Picking up the cells. Yeah, I can see. I can
8 to 10 cells per blastocyst per embryo.
Yeah. Okay. So 8 to 10 cells in the right hand pipette, about now to be injected into the embryo. You're using the left pipette to push the embryo, are you, towards the right pipette?
Yeah.
Yep. Okay. I feel like I'm rushing you. My presence hovering over you. I'm sorry about this, Tony.
Okay.
Take your time.
So now I'm just releasing the cells into my embryo. And they should then incorporate with the cell mass of the embryo to create our genetically modified mouse.
Okay. Thank you very much, Tony.
Okay.
Thank you. Let's introduce you to Dr. Martin Frey, who's head of biological resources here at the Mary Lyon Centre. First of all, good morning.
Good morning to you.
How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Okay, so we've just seen the diabetes cells go into that embryo. What happens to that embryo now?
Now we've transferred the cells into the embryo, we need to implant them into a female mouse so that we can render her pregnant, and she will actually carry those embryos through to term and give birth to some baby mice.
And how long does it take from implanting the embryo for the mouse to have her pups?
In this particular procedure, it'll take between 17 and 18 days before the pups are born.
Okay. And where have you taken the embryo from?
Well, the embryos were actually harvested yesterday. They're collected from female mice that were mated. They're actually superovulated, like one does in a human IVF clinic. So we'd superovulated the mice, and we'd collected the embryos from female mice yesterday. We'd cultured them in the incubator overnight so that they then developed into this particular stage of embryo that we can implant, which is effectively a hollow ball of cells called a blastocyst.
Okay. And once the mouse gives birth to the pups, what will you do with the pups?
This is the exciting stage. So we're actually injecting black cells, cells collected from black mice, into embryos that have been collected from white mice. The pups, when they're born, or that's the baby mice when they're born, they're actually naked. But after 4 or 5 days, the coat colour comes through, the hair starts to come through. And we get our first indication that the projects have been successful because we can see patches of dark and white fur. And this is very good news for us.
And how is that relevant to diabetes, though?
What we actually need to do in this particular diabetes model is establish a colony of mice that can then be passed on to the researcher.
Yeah.
And we need to do this. We need to make sure that we can pass this diabetes gene from one generation of mice to the next. So we have to mate the animals, and we actually test the pups that are born, the progeny, to mm-hmm. see that they're carrying this particular gene. And once we've confirmed that they're able to carry the gene, then we can pass on the mice to the researcher.
Okay, and that's when they'll start doing various tests and then... the results are taken from that, and the scientists trying to work out what the results show.
That's exactly the case. That's exactly
what we should make clear, though, is the embryo, the female mouse from which you've taken the embryo, is killed before you harvest the embryos.
That is correct, yes.
Okay, let's take us over to the other side of this lab, which is about the size of a large office. Mm. You'd probably be a CEO if you had an office this size, I reckon. So we go to the other end of the lab, where you are going to show us how you kill a mouse.
Exactly.
Go on.
I was going to say this is an essential part of the process. We've got a technician in front of the laminar flow hood at the moment.
Before you do this, just explain why you have to kill the female mouse first before you take the embryos out of her.
Yeah, okay. So we've had to superovulate the mice, which is a regulated procedure. We can only use mice once.
That's part of your licensing.
It's part of the licensing agreement. So the most efficient way of operating now is to kill the mice. It's very quick. It's a humane procedure. And this allows us then to take out the uterus and then flush the embryos from the uterus. These embryos are then incubated overnight and then injected the following day.
Right, so why couldn't you put the mouse under anaesthetic and withdraw, take the uterus out and then the embryos, put the uterus back and bring the mouse back to life, as it were?
Well, as I say, we're permitted to take one procedure, subject the mouse to one procedure,
that's
the superovulation procedure. The anaesthesia itself, although...
Put the licensing stuff to one side. Yeah. Is there any particular scientific reason why you couldn't do it in the way I've suggested? Is it because the uterus is too small, or it's too fiddly, or it's just not worth it because it's only a mouse, or what?
Well, it's certainly not the case that it isn't worth it because it's only a mouse. The body parts of a mouse, of course, very small, and all the dissections have to be done under a microscope. But for practical reasons, it doesn't make sense to anaesthetise mice, to harvest the embryos, and then keep them and then transfer the embryos back into those individual mice.
Doesn't make sense to who?
Well, it doesn't make sense ethically to do this because we're subjecting these individual mice to quite an extensive range of invasive procedures, and this is, of course, not what we don't want to do. So we try and separate the superovulation. The mice are injected, they're superovulated. We then kill the mice. The embryos are harvested, say, cultured, injected the following day, and then we get separate mice that we can then anaesthetise, and it's these the embryo recipient mice. They've only had one procedure, and we believe that to be a more ethical approach to the type of experiment that we're doing.
All right, so we have here one of the technicians or microinjectionists.
Yes, you're
nodding. It's one or the other. Yes. Okay. And just let me in a sort of larger than a shoebox size, slightly larger than that, plastic transparent. You call them cages, but that gives the wrong impression, I think, to listeners, because there's no metal there and they're not cages. It's a big plastic transparent box, and inside there we have 4 tiny white mice. Okay. And you're going to show us, and you're going to describe, if that's all right with you, Dr. Frey, what your technician is doing.
Yeah. Here. So what the technician is doing is now we're picking the mouse up from the tail from the cage. She's allowing the mouse to grip on a cage top, and this stabilizes the mouse. And then she's very quickly going to grasp the neck of the mouse and break the neck. In fact, it's a process we call cervical dislocation. So it's very quick, and she'll do it now. There we go. And that is it.
So what the technician did was, and the mice is still kicking, I have to say. The mice, the legs are Yeah. And it's still moving.
So this is a nervous reaction. The neck has been broken and the mouse is dead, but yes, there's some nervous activity and the back legs are kicking, but they've stopped now.
Well, how do you know that wasn't sort of 12, 13 seconds of absolute pain as the mouse
because,
was dying?
We'll give you the opportunity to feel the break of the neck. The neck is completely broken and been severed from the collarbone. So we know precisely that mouse has died, and it died instantaneously, despite the kicking of the back legs.
Okay. So what the technician did was hold the mice with the tail in her left hand and with her right thumb press down on the neck, effectively.
Yes.
So dislocating the spinal cord from the brain.
Effectively.
Yes.
Effectively. That's exactly what happens.
Okay. All right. Okay. Right, let me read some messages from our listeners. Bruce says, I think the use of animals is absolutely abhorrent. Not only that, I think it's detrimental to our own evolution and indeed survival. Is it any wonder that we are the most violent and destructive force on this planet when we feel we can exploit, torture and kill at will? Ed in Harrogate says, do you really think they're going to show you what actually happens in these testing labs? No, they will show you what they want you to see. Nothing like they really do. I have a friend who works for a testing lab that use monkeys. He says it's awful what they do. I mean, that's one of the downsides of a program like this, Professor Brown, in that obviously we can only see what you choose to show us. And we have to describe exactly what we see, describe what you choose to show us, and then our listeners can make up their own minds. So if I ask you, you know, is there terrible stuff going on here that you are hiding from us, I know you're going to say to me no, because we have licenses and you know, there are strict regulations.
Well, first of all, we are licensed. We can be visited at any time by the Home Office Inspector to ensure that we're working within our license and that we're working according to, as Martin mentioned, regulated procedures. But I think what you're seeing today actually is the life of a mouse in our mouse clinic at Harwell. We're looking at mice with diseases, just like humans would go to a clinic to find out what's wrong with them and why are they going wrong. And I think you're seeing all of those processes here today. Obviously, you can't see every particular test, every particular motion that that takes place. But you've seen the whole centre. I think we're giving you a good guide of what really happens here.
JC says, my 12-year-old son has a rare condition called pulmonary hypertension. He's treated with a cocktail of drugs which keep him alive. No doubt these drugs were tested on animals at some point. I've often wondered about animal rights activists and what they would do if they found themselves in my position. Would they stay true to their beliefs and deny their child treatment? In rats, my son's condition has been cured, and I hope and pray that one day this will come true for my son. We've now walked into Ward 6, which is called the Experimental Ward, and in front of us are about 10,000 mice. They are grouped together in groups of four or five, and each of the four or five is placed in one of the transparent plastic, slightly larger than a shoebox-sized boxes. They have their own bedding, they have food, they have water, obviously. There are about 60 different experiments taking place at any one time at this centre. The smell, for me, it smells like haddock. I don't know why. It's quite a disgusting smell. 10,000 mice, to me, is a haddock smell. But I assume, Professor Steve Brown, it's a smell you get used to, is it?
It is a smell that you get used to if you work in an animal house, yes.
Tell us about the licensing system, because I know individuals need licenses if they're handling mice, and obviously you need licenses for each project that you're carrying out here.
Yeah, the personal and project licenses. And the project licenses are of course, licensed by the Home Office, but they go through a local ethical review process. So importantly, when we're thinking about doing an experiment or a project with our mice, we have to write down very carefully precisely what the experiment will be, and we have to assess what are the costs to the mice in terms of any pain or suffering that might occur, and also what are the benefits, what are the aims of the project. And that balance between costs and benefits is absolutely vital.
Have you ever had an application for a license turned down?
We haven't had an application turned down by the Home Office. What we have had is our ethical review committee go back and ask us again, well, we don't really think the benefits there outweigh the costs involved. Look at that again. Is there a better way to do that? Or, importantly, should we be using mice to do that particular experiment?
You're required to have a license for, quote, any experimental or other scientific procedure applied to a protected animal which may have the effect of causing that animal pain, suffering, distress, or lasting harm, which is an acknowledgement that they will all have some sort of pain or distress, but it's the weighing up of the sort of costs and benefits.
But importantly, the law requires us to minimise absolutely that pain and distress. And that's clearly where welfare is absolutely critical. If looking at the mice here in the cages, you can see that they're all scuttering around. They're looking pretty happy. And, of course, it's our job to find any mouse that is looking as if it's suffering and needs either treatment or other action taken.
And the Home Office also say that any experiment involving animals is only allowed when there are no other alternative research techniques available.
Absolutely. We only do experiments on mice when that is the only route that we can use to find that critical relationship between genes and disease that I mentioned before.
Let's introduce you to Shell Stewart, who is a ward manager here. She's also a PhD student. Hi, Shell, how are you?
Hi, yeah, I'm just getting over a cold, so I'm a bit croaky, but otherwise all right.
That's all right. We don't mind croaky people on Five Live. Tell us what your job is and what it is in relation to the mice that we see here.
So I'm the ward manager. I run a team of animal care staff who look after the welfare of the animals in this ward. They check the mice every morning, so the first job that anyone ever does is we come in, we pick up every cage, we look at the mice, we make sure they're all looking healthy. We do this every day, Saturday, Sunday, Christmas Day. They also do the cage changing, so we take the cage bases, we take the mouse to the hood, we pick it up, we move it into a clean cage so it's got a clean environment. We do this around about once a week, but sometimes we leave them for another week because the mice actually prefer to be in an environment that smells of them.
Right.
So if the cage isn't too dirty, then we leave it and we clean it the week after instead.
And inside here, we've obviously got the food pellets, if you like, which contain what?
So the food pellets are a completely balanced diet made by a specific company that makes diet for experimental animals. And they've got a full range of protein and fat and carbohydrate. That's exactly what the mice need.
And you've got the water there, obviously. And they have what look like loo rolls, but they're actually fun tunnels.
Yeah, we call them fun tunnels. The mice use these. They sort of run around in them. They hide in them. Sometimes they shred them up to add them to their bedding. They also have white material that they use for nesting. And you can see in the cages we've just put the nesting in, it's just sort of spread around. And then by the time you look at it the next day, the mice have been round, gathered it all up, made it into a nice little nest to live in.
And some might say, actually, your job is a sort of contradiction. You're here purely to look after their welfare.
Yeah.
But what sort of welfare is it if they're being experimented on, tested on, and in some cases killed?
Their licences are very specific in what you're allowed to do, and they have what we call humane endpoints. So we have to make sure that any experiment that's done doesn't exceed any endpoints that are written in the licence. So the animal care staff know what we're allowed to do on certain mice. Lots and lots of mice are on what we call mild protocols, which means they shouldn't really suffer anything obvious that we can see. We're just looking at the development of genes in sort of maybe younger mice that haven't developed a gene yet, or maybe we're looking at what the gene does in an embryo, so we never see any sort of adverse effects in adult mice. And then if we did see an adverse effect in an adult mouse that wasn't related to the gene, you know, maybe it was just sick for some other reason,
yeah,
then we would know, actually, that's not what that license is looking at, and we should humanely kill this animal just so it's not suffering anymore unnecessarily.
Right. Do you really care about mice?
Yeah, we definitely do. When we interview for new technicians who look after the mice, one of the things, the main thing that we look for is actually a genuine interest in the welfare of animals. And if you see the text, they've all got pets at home, they've all got horses, you know, we've got people with extensive like reptiles and things at home. Like, everybody really cares about the mice.
And Steve Brown said earlier that they all look pretty happy. I mean, I have no idea what a happy mouse looks like, but potentially it's not a mouse in an environment like this, because this must be totally unnatural to them.
Well, this is what they're used to. So they're not caught from the wild and then brought in here. They're born here. They've always lived in this environment. So this for them is quite normal. We try to keep them in as natural an environment as possible. So they always have food available so they can go and get it whenever. They've got material to make bed in. They've got material to dig in. We always keep them in groups because mice are very social animals. So we try not to keep them on their own because that's a bit stressful for them. You know, we do as much as we possibly can to make the environment as much like their natural environment as possible.
And when you check them each morning, what are you looking for? And presumably you find dead mice amongst in the boxes.
We do occasionally, but it's not it's not that many. So we probably find, in here, we probably find 3 or 4 mice a week found dead from 10,000 mice. And they're generally not because of the genes. They're not because of the genes that we've altered. It's generally just, you know, sometimes things die of you know, just other diseases. So what we're mainly looking for when we do the check in the morning is we check they've got sufficient food and water to last until the next check. And we check all the mice. So we make sure we look on the cage card on the front of the cage,
yes,
see how many mice are supposed to be there. And then we make sure we check each mouse individually. Is it sitting on its own? Is its fur a bit ruffled up? Has it got any wounds or something that shouldn't be there? Because, you know, none of them should really have wounds unless they've been rowing overnight or something.
Rowing?
Yeah.
Okay. And so some of the labels on the front, I mean, these cages, as you call them, but these transparent boxes are piled up on top of each other here. Mm-hmm. They've got 9 up and 7 across. So you get a, hopefully listeners get a sort of image of the scale of the mice in these boxes here. Some of the labelling on the front, what does this mean, for example? So we've got barcodes and then you've got letters and numbers underneath, which of course means nothing to the layperson's eye, but you tell us, Shell.
Each mouse is an individual name, really. So we generally call the strain the name of the gene that we've altered,
yeah,
and then the number refers to the mating number. So if we set up 5 matings, they're numbered 1 to 5, and then the litter the next number is the litter. So if it's the first litter, it's 0.1. If it's the second litter, it's 0.2. And then each mouse is individually identified by a letter of the alphabet. So at any point, we can tell exactly which mouse is which and what it's for and what we're going to do with it.
And why might mice have a row overnight? What's going on there?
it doesn't happen that often. But you know, sometimes if the males have, you know, trying to decide who's the dominant one in the cage or something, they sometimes have a bit of a rollabout together. But it's not, you know, it's not very common. But it is one of the things that we look for in the morning, because we obviously don't want them to have any sort of issues like that, because apart from affecting the welfare, it will also affect the science.
All right, so we're going to move from this ward, which is what you call it, which has got these 10,000 mice, into one of the rooms at the back here, where we're going to talk with Professor Shell. Thank you. Oh, you're staying with us. Yep, Shell is staying with us, one of the ward managers. And Professor Steve Brown, one of the directors of the Mary Lyon Centre, is here. And we're going to talk through a particular test. Steve, just wander over here. So this is called the Sherpa test, which is an acronym for Smith, Klein, Beecham, Harwell, Imperial College, Royal London Hospital, Phenotype Assessment. Put all that together, you get Sherpa. And we've got 4 mice in one of your transparent boxes, and separate to that, 1 tiny mouse on a grid surrounded by a cylinder, effectively a transparent cylinder. Tell us what this test is about.
Well, this allows the technician to observe the mouse, to see its posture, to see its gait, to see how it travels around on the grid, which gives you an idea of its motor ability.
And how is this mouse modified? Which genes have been modified?
I don't know which particular genes have been modified in this mouse, but all of our mice go through this particular test.
Okay.
And It's an Alzheimer's mice, actually, an Alzheimer's model.
So these are baseline for some Alzheimer's mice. So we screen the Alzheimer's mice, but we obviously have to know what a normal mouse looks like as well in the same circumstance. So these are just normal mice.
Right. Okay. And so you're checking how they move across this grid, whether they're moving on one side or their gait is balanced or that kind of thing?
Yes, exactly. And in fact, the Sherpa test has a whole series of relatively simple tests. It's a bit like going to your doctor, and you'll probably remember they look at your neurological responses by tapping your knee, for example, or perhaps running a pointer across the base of your foot. So we're looking at a battery of tests here, which are relatively straightforward, that give us an immediate assessment of what might be wrong with our mouse.
Okay, but as this is a normal mouse, in inverted commas,
we would expect to see nothing wrong with
you
it.
You would expect...
But of course, we have to look at controls.
Yes, yeah, of course, yeah, yeah. And then you can compare what the Alzheimer's mouse does.
Yeah, yeah.
Why can't you do this with human beings? I mean, you just referred to the kind of testing that you get if you go to your GP surgery.
Of course, we can find this out about human beings, but the difficulty is that we can't make that specific relationship between altered altering a specific gene and seeing what the outcome is in this battery of tests.
Because in humans, you don't know which genes have modified to give an individual Alzheimer's yet.
We don't, indeed. We don't have that specific ability, and perhaps we wouldn't want to do this. This is an ethical question all of its own, to modify humans to see what the outcome is if we change particular genes. Now, of course...
But if you can work out the relevant gene in a mouse, you can potentially translate that to a human being.
Exactly. What we can then do is go into the human population and look for variations, changes in DNA in the human populations, and see whether there's an association in the human population between changes in their genes and some of the diseases that we're seeing here.
Okay.
So that's the first step in being able to translate our knowledge from mouse into the human population.
All right. So let's talk about a couple of the other tests that you do here. The hot plate test doesn't sound good.
It's a fairly modest test in the sense that you're simply putting a mouse on a plate which is relatively warm.
52 degrees.
To see whether the mouse will lift its feet. There's no, for example, blistering of the skin or anything like that. It's simply to ask, can the mouse respond to pain? It's very quick. The major reaction of the mouse is simply to lift its paws. If we see that response, that appropriate response, we know that that's a normal mouse. If it doesn't lift its paws within a certain time, we get it off the hot plate, clearly.
Right.
So it's, a very simple, non-invasive test. The kind of test that a doctor might do to you, might prick your finger to see, can you feel
pain?
But
are you saying that's the equivalent for a human being? A prick your finger or prick...
Yes, I think it's the equivalent.
You think it is, or do you know?
Well, of course, we can't get directly into the mind of a mouse, but we go back to this issue that Shell was mentioning about welfare, always looking after the mice and doing the minimum that's necessary to find out the phenotype.
Right. And so, again, it's just worth explaining again, the point of the hot plate test is what?
It's to see whether the mouse can respond to pain. We know that developing improved methods of controlling pain will come from a better study of some of our genes. We need to find out where defects in genes cause poor responses to pain.
We've already described earlier that the mice are picked up by the tail. We saw that just before 10:30 when one of the technicians killed a mouse. The RSPCA say picking a mouse up by the tail is particularly unpleasant. You say it doesn't cause them any suffering, but actually, does anybody really know?
Well, all our experience, remember all of the technicians around here, they all work with animals all the time. They can see an animal that is not well, that is suffering. And we know, in fact, from many years of experience, that picking up a mouse by the tail is its most comfortable way. Not hanging it by the tail, picking it up by the tail and then putting it on your arm so it can sit there and that you can observe it. Or picking it up and putting it on the top of the cage. But it's the easiest and most non-invasive way to actually work and handle our mice.
Tell us about the swim test. Tell our listeners about this. Essentially, you put a mouse in water for a minute. Mm. For what purpose?
Well, one of the things we look at with the swim test is whether the mouse has what's called a vestibular dysfunction. Now, we have mice who don't hear very well. That's something that can happen when our genes go wrong. But often associated with hearing, this happens in the human population as well, you have dizziness, you have vestibular problems as well. So a simple way to test this in mouse is to put them in some warm water and let them swim around. They swim quite happily.
They're not natural swimmers, are they?
They're not. Well, they have to swim in the wild. It's something that's part of their routine in the wild. They'll almost certainly be swimming. But what we look and see is whether they swim appropriately across the surface or whether they tumble down into the water. If they tumble down into the water, they clearly have a vestibular problem, and then they're immediately removed from the water.
Okay. And again, the official guidelines on the swim test say mice should be scooped up and rescued immediately on displaying underwater tumbling
exactly.
or any distressing behaviour.
Yeah, yeah.
How often do you see distressing behaviour in a mouse?
Very rarely, because in fact vestibular problems don't crop up that often. They do sometimes. They're often associated, as I said, with hearing loss. And that's one of the things that we must look for in terms of making this relationship between genes and disease.
Okay. Tell us about the water maze test.
Well, if you like, that's another evolution of the swim test. But this is a behavioural test. It's about the ability of a mouse to learn and find an underwater platform in a bath of water. So the mice are actually trained to find this platform. They swim around until they find the platform. They can recognise where the platform actually is. And then having done that, you're effectively assessing the ability of the mouse as it continues to do that test, the ability to learn and very quickly get to the platform in subsequent rounds of swimming.
Okay, let me read you some messages. We're going to move now from this particular ward. We're going to move somewhere else to in the Mary Lyon Centre. Please ask the director when the last HMI surprise visit happened at the centre. So he's talking about the inspection regime. Who would know that? This is Mark Gardner, who's the facilities manager here. Last surprise inspection. Let's keep walking as we talk.
The surprise inspection was actually less than 1 month ago.
Okay, and what happens when they arrive at your door?
We invite them in. They actually take them around the facility.
What are they looking out for?
They're just looking to see if we've got cages that are labelled correctly, that there's no mice undergoing any procedure that we haven't got licences for, and talking about our current welfare needs.
Okay. Kevin Watkinson would like to know how many mice have died in the 10 years they have been working on this potential glue ear development. I'm not sure if anybody would know the specific number, but Would you be able to hazard a guess, Professor Brown?
I would say it would be, overall, we've probably used about 1,000 mice in all of our studies on the glue ear.
Martin Cook in Bedford says they must keep up the good work for the benefit of stricken families, especially as we live to a much older age with new and more issues. Bruce says, hi Victoria, I'm uncomfortable with this programme and these people, as a matter of interest, would you ask them if any of them have any pets? Shell told us a little earlier that
almost everybody has pets, yeah. The people definitely care about the animals, that's why they do this job. They want to come in, they want to give the animals the best welfare, the best environment that we can possibly do.
Sarah says, your director is suggesting that compassion towards the mice is their top priority. That's ludicrous. As to mice being 99% the same as humans, it just goes to show how important that 1% is and how complicated this issue of genetics really is. Knocking this or that gene out or adding this or that gene will not translate to humans. It's all Alice in Wonderland stuff that causes great suffering to animals. It's bogus science, but the public have bought into it. Sal says, hi Victoria, this subject is quite fascinating. Without this work, a lot of vital research would not happen. Alan says, animal testing is distasteful but essential. We want the cures, but we dislike the process to get them. If we want the cures to big illnesses, so we must accept the lab tests that definitely need to be done. And we're now in Ward 4, which is the diabetes and obesity ward. Again, we have probably around 10,000 mice in those familiar now transparent plastic boxes, row upon row upon row. And the smell, the haddock smell, I'm getting used to it. NHS figures show that in England, a quarter of all adults are obese. And nearly 3 million people in the UK have diabetes, which occurs when the pancreas doesn't produce enough insulin, which helps convert glucose into energy. Over the last 6 months, scientists here believe they have potentially identified a gene, the AFMID gene, A-F for Freddie, M-I-D, AFMID gene, which they think may be one of the genes which is involved in controlling insulin and therefore could tell them something new about diabetes. Without that AFMID gene, a mouse, potentially a human being, will not be able to use glucose properly. Now, the work hasn't yet been published. Professor Roger Cox is group leader of the genetics of type 2 diabetes group. Just come a little closer to this microphone because you are much taller than me.
Okay.
So the reason that it's significant that the work hasn't yet been published is what?
Well, it's early days. So this gene has come out of, I think, one of the programs you heard about earlier on, which was trying to attach phenotypes to every gene in the genome. So we have about 20,000 odd genes in mouse and same in human. So this came out of an initial screen looking for phenotypes that are associated with knocking out that particular gene. And it turned out it had this nice, interesting interesting diabetes phenotype. So overt diabetes with glucose in the urine, for example. So we've just begun to look at it. So it's quite early days. We think it's probably a problem with the cells that secrete insulin. So these cells are found in the pancreas within structures called islets. So there's beta cells that make insulin and other cells that make other hormones. So we think it might be a problem there, but this is very early work at the moment.
And when you say early work, how many months, years have you been working on it?
Well, we've only just started to work on this in the last 3 or 4 months. There's been some previous work which alerted us to its interest. So
in terms of the further work that you need to do to be more definitive in the way you're talking to us about this acne,
yes,
gene,
yeah,
you're talking years, are you?
Well, we're probably talking a couple of years to really nail down what's going wrong in these mice. So we need to look carefully at what the problem is, why the islets aren't functioning properly, why they aren't secreting enough insulin. So to really understand what this role this gene has. I mean, it's a completely new association between this gene and diabetes. There was nothing known previously about it. So it's a novel way in. And what we're trying to do is understand the underlying biology and the science that underpins diabetes and obesity, and also the genetics as well. So we're not only looking for new genes that might be associated with diabetes and obesity, but we're also taking genes that have come out of big human studies. So there's large mapping projects that have been done in human populations that have identified 50-odd diabetes genes and a similar number of obesity genes. And the question is, what is the function of those genes? How are they working? And one of the ways that we can tackle that question is to alter those genes in mice and look at the effects. So really try to understand the function of these genes that have been discovered in humans, as well as trying to discover things for newly in mouse as well.
Right. I read a message from a listener earlier who said, obesity, diabetes, they are lifestyle type illnesses. What is the point of them doing research on mice to look at that area of life?
Well, there is a strong genetic component to both diabetes and obesity. And obesity is a big risk factor for type 2 diabetes. It's very difficult for people to lose weight, and there might be all sorts of reasons that may reflect your genetic constitution. It may be influenced by other factors in your life that make it difficult to choose the right foods and to take exercise. So I think it's a complicated problem. It's not a simple thing to solve.
Just eat less and do more exercise. It's absolutely not.
No, that would certainly help, but it's not just that, and it's really hard for people to do that. So I think, you know, we're trying a number of different approaches here. We're trying to understand the basic biology. We're trying to get at the genes. Ultimately, we hope to be able to move things through into therapeutic investigation, so into pipelines that might lead to drugs. So we're trying to do something for the benefit of the patient, and people need help to lose weight, and we need better drugs to treat diabetes as well. There's a limited range of drugs, and they vary in their effectiveness, especially as the duration of diabetes becomes longer for an individual.
And when you get to a point where you think you've potentially located a diabetes gene, this AFMID gene, is that and again, it's a naive question, I'm sure you'll think, but is that a eureka moment, or is that weeks and weeks of data and looking at things and thinking about things?
This took quite a long time to get to that point. So somebody had to make that particular knockout and then had to apply the tests to discover that they have diabetes. It's not, you look at the mouse, you wouldn't know it had diabetes. You have to look at the glucose in its urine and the blood glucose concentrations, and then you know it has diabetes because they run around quite happily in the cage. You wouldn't necessarily notice, although in that case you probably notice they were drinking more water, which is
So are you excited by this?
Yes, we are. I think it's a novel finding, and we're going to do more work on it, and hopefully it'll lead to something exciting. And we're running a number of projects in parallel as well. So we're looking at other genes that are potentially quite exciting as well. And we have a long-standing project on the fat mass and obesity gene that was discovered in humans in 2007. And we've been making different variations of that gene in the mouse and looking at its function to really start to try and understand how that gene works.
And have you got anywhere yet?
Well, we know it's probably a central nervous system effect. So we're beginning to understand how it works, and we are making progress, and we're trying a few compounds as well that might inhibit the gene just to see if there's any potential there. So it's a long haul, and but I think we're making real progress on that particular.
Do you find it difficult to try to describe the kind of work you do and the length of time it takes to people like me? I mean, I read in the newspapers today, a binge drinking gene has potentially been discovered.
Well, it is hard to explain because the genes that we're talking about that have been mapped in human populations are quite often small effect genes, and it's sort of understanding what that means in terms of diabetes and obesity at the
because
population level.
Wrongly, we immediately leap to a conclusion of, hooray, they've discovered the binge drinking gene or the diabetes gene, whatever it is.
It's a complex problem. There are lots of genes involved. A lot of them may be small effect. It's a complex system. So in diabetes, the reason we're working in mouse is because it involves interactions between lots of different tissues. So the liver, fat, skeletal muscle, the brain, the gut. It's a very complex interacting system, and we need to use something like the mouse to model it.
Thank you, Professor Roger Cox. Also with us is Lee. Lee, again, doesn't want us to use her surname. She is a PhD student, started working here at the age of 19 as a lab technician. Lee, just explain to our listeners why you'd rather we didn't use your surname. You're wearing a mask, I should say, so we're going to listen very carefully to what you're saying.
I'm wearing the mask for the benefit for the mice, because we have to protect those from for anything that we can pass on to them, keep them as clean as possible. I am more comfortable with people not using knowing my surname in this. There are still some people out there who are not so happy with animal research.
Okay. So, what have we got here? We've got one of the boxes in front of us with a number of mice in. Their food, one of those fun tunnels, which looks like a loo roll. We've got two mice, in fact. So just, and you're picking one up by its tail and placing it in your left hand and picking the other one up.
So what we've got here, we've got two mice that are siblings. So what we have is one mouse is slightly fatter than the other. That's the one in my right hand. And this one has got a change in one of its genes that's involved with metabolic pathways. And because of this change, this one eats more food and becomes fatter and ultimately develops type 2 diabetes.
Okay.
What the one on the left doesn't.
Right. So it's to do with the gene being changed rather than the fact it simply eats more food and therefore becomes fatter.
Yes, in this case it is, yes.
Okay. And so the mouse with altered genes still get fat even when they're on a controlled diet.
Yeah, so what we did was we put them on a diet. So we basically gave them a known amount of food that we know that the smaller wild-type animal that doesn't have the altered gene would eat, and this is about 10 grams less food a week, and it still got as fat as it would have done if it had normal access to its food.
Okay, why can't you do this on human beings?
Well, mice don't cheat.
They
can't sneak a chocolate bar, you know, they're in a controlled environment here, and they're doing exactly, you know, what we, you know, they've got controlled light and temperature and how much food that we're giving them.
Okay. Let me read some messages. We're going to see a blood sample being taken in a moment, I think, Lee.
Yes.
But let me read some messages. Where are we doing the blood sample? In there? We're just
going
to move into a small lab area. Messages from you. Mark in Leeds says, I'm a young scientist, far removed from biology, but I'm a big advocate of animal testing. I think it's great that your program is raising awareness for the amazing things that this lab is doing. But sadly, there will always be uneducated people exposed to the propaganda who won't listen to reason. Kevin Macclesfield says, sounds like extremely highly educated group of competent people doing a valuable job for the benefit of us all. Mal in Bucks says, one wonders whether any protester has ever declined medical treatment because of their views over this type of research. Well, we'll ask the representative from Animal Aid that in just a moment. First, Lee is going to show us a quick blood test on a mouse, I think.
Yes, sorry. So my colleague here is carrying out an intraperitoneal glucose tolerance test. So we're basically looking to see if these mice are diabetic. And this is similar to tests that they do in humans to check for their diabetes levels as well.
Okay. So what's going to happen now then?
So she's finding the correct mouse. She's identifying it by its ear code and just placing it in a manner that is calm and as stress-free as possible. There's a previous nick has been made in the tail, which was done after applying a local anaesthetic to the tail.
Okay.
So this is better than the...
And how do you apply that local anaesthetic? It's just cream, is it?
It's just a topical cream that you just rub into the tail.
Right.
And then she's just got the smallest drop of blood possible to then actually read on a glucose strip monitor, similar to diabetics use to check their glucose levels, just to see what its glucose level is.
Okay, and once you have that information, it's inputted into a computer, which is to her right, and then what?
And then she'll go away and analyse the data. So these mice have either got a variant in the gene or not, and she can look at it in the groups together.
Okay. All right, thank you very much, Lee. Thank you. Let's talk to a vet here at the Mary Lyon Centre, Chris Trower.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Professor Steve Brown is with us too, one of the directors still. We're going to talk to listeners as well in a second, as well as the representative from Animal Aid. Chris Troer, as a vet, do mice ever naturally get diabetes, Alzheimer's?
I'm not sure about mice getting it naturally, but certainly most other species will or can get diabetes. Dogs, cats, and most of the other pet species can develop diabetes, yes.
Right. So, Steve, Professor Steve Brown, if mice don't naturally get diabetes or Alzheimer's, doesn't that mean that the entire model on which the experiments are based are too simplistic, too crude?
No, they can actually. They can develop it. We can, just like in the human population, you can get spontaneous mutations which lead either the mice to develop diseases such as diabetes, cardiovascular diseases, Alzheimer's. But, of course, it happens very rarely. And what we're doing here is and this has a relationship to animal numbers by actually targeting the genes that we want to change and asking what are the diseases that develop when we target those genes. Will we quickly get the answers that we need to translate that information into human healthcare?
What about the fact that, for example, if we look at testing when it comes to strokes, hundreds of treatments for stroke have been developed in animals which have not translated into successful treatment for human beings?
Well, I always come back to this point that if we develop any treatment for humans, any new drug, we must have a real understanding of how that drug works and a real expectation that it's going to work in humans. And what we do here at Harwell is we're actually finding out the basic biology and also the potential treatments that give us confidence that those drugs will work in humans. If we didn't do that, it would be a lottery.
Okay. Let's talk to Adrian Storwood then, a scientific consultant at Animal Aid, an animal rights group. He's been listening to our programme since 10 o'clock this morning, since we started broadcasting from the Mary Lyon Centre. It's worth saying as well, we approached various animal testing laboratories up and down the country. All of them said no, apart from the Mary Lyon Centre. Adrian Storwood, hello, good morning to you. Thanks for your patience. Tell us what you think about what you've heard so far this morning.
Good morning, Victoria. Well, it's been a fascinating look, and I think some of your listeners are already starting to suspect, perhaps, that all is not quite as cosy in the world of the genetically modified mouse as the presentation we've had. So some of the aspects have clearly been presented nicely, but other aspects really haven't been expressed at all in the presentation we've just heard. I think it's important to begin with. We can come back to Harwell, I think, afterwards if we like, but it's important to look at the whole overall GM experiment program that goes on in the UK. We're not just talking about Harwell here. So, you know, there's, you know, at least 2 million procedures that take place on GM mice every year, certainly in 2011. And it's across the board. We're talking about really the largest single area of lab animal cruelty in the UK today. The mice suffer sort of a chain of misery, really, right through the procedures to create the new mouse lines, the harmful effects of their genetic alterations, through to the subsequent colony breeding, and then the experiments they suffer, plus their traumatic death. We've heard a little bit about that there. So it's not just diabetes and obesity research, although we've got problems with those aspects as well, clearly, but it's cardiac failure experiments, cancer experiments, emphysema experiments, extremely cruel psychiatric research, epilepsy, where mice might die of continuous seizures, Alzheimer's research, which involves, you know, a lot of cruel behavioural testing as well. You know, mice suffer in all kinds of different ways as a consequence of their genetic alterations. They're literally bred to suffer. There's all sorts of side effects which occur through genetic modification. These techniques are unpredictable by their very nature. So, you know, a lot of the pups die in utero. Many die postnatally from all sorts of diseases and malformations. The mass culling of mice, we've heard a bit about that, but there's literally millions and millions of unreported. Well, it's we must remember that it's not a licensed procedure to kill a mouse in the UK. So behind every genetically modified mouse, every founder mouse, there's hundreds and hundreds of mouse who've just been killed off as literally so many failures and almost quite literally binned. You know, we've seen undercover investigations which have found, you know, actually bin bags full literally of mice, some of them still alive through inadequate gassing procedures. So it's a whole chain of suffering. We can look at Harwell, but we've got to look at the whole wider picture as well. And across many labs in the UK, there's inordinate amounts of mouse suffering, and we've got to get that into perspective from the very beginning.
For you, the ends never justify the means.
Well, no, because our objections to the GM mouse experiments, they encompass human suffering as well as that of animals. Our objections are twofold. I mean, one is clearly the cruelty involved, and we've seen a little speck of that, a tiny a bit so far. There's plenty more. But also we're talking about the benefits for people. They're just not coming through. We're talking about obesity. I'll give you a quote from a guy called Daniel Bessenden, who's a professor of medicine at the University of Colorado. He said last year, for all the science we have in transgenic mice about the central control of feeding, we haven't really got any effective drugs out of it. Maybe it's because feeding in a mouse is different from feeding in humans, or humans don't eat because they're hungry, because the food tastes good and there's social aspects to it. So that's one aspect of transgenic knowledge which isn't coming through. Diabetes, another quote from this year. Despite decades of studying rodent models of type 1 diabetes, no therapy capable of preventing or curing type 1 diabetes has successfully translated from rodents to humans. And the quote goes on to say that the reason for that is fundamental differences between the rodent and animals and human species. That there's elements of that across the board. Every researcher in the journals you can read is publishing wearying comments saying that this research isn't delivering for people. So okay. We think we've got a firm ethical argument for people as well as just the mice.
Professor Steve Brown, talk to Adrian.
I think to Adrian's made a number of points, but to talk to several of them. First and foremost, it is delivering. I talked about the glue ear work that we've just been doing, which is identifying completely new and novel treatments for a very important childhood condition that leads to social exclusion, difficulties with language development. You mentioned obesity. We're really beginning to understand now the underlying genetic bases for obesity in the human population. And I think it's wrong to say, and it's too early to say, that we expect treatments right today. What we're beginning to understand, as Roger Cox mentioned, is some of the genes that are key to developing obesity, which have been potentially identified in the human population. And now in the mouse, we're beginning to understand what they actually do in a mammal. And that will lead through to new treatments. And I emphasize again, I think this is an absolutely critical point. As we develop new healthcare and new therapeutics for humans, we must have a real understanding and a real expectation of how drugs might work. And contrary to what Adrian said, genetic modification is an exquisite tool to alter the mouse genome and to be able to deliver those insights that will really turn into healthcare. And there are many examples of healthcare changes all the way from insulin and penicillin through the development of aromatase inhibitors for breast cancer, the study of prion diseases, the development of anti-TNF-alpha inhibitors for rheumatoid arthritis. All of these have been major changes in healthcare that have come through careful animal experimentation.
Properly. There's several leading authority figures which would take issue with your statement that things are delivering. Professor Lord Winston, he's certainly no fan of ours. He's a staunch supporter of animal experiments. And he went on to say in June 2012 that the hype about genomic research in general is complete balls. He said that genetic studies certainly don't apply to all cancers, or even most cancers. The genome's not really applying to heart disease, which will affect one-third of us. And frankly, it's been a real disappointment in the brain. 2010, Harold Varmus, who's now the director of the US National Cancer Institute, said genomics is the way to do science, not medicine. You're doing basic research. You're doing... A lot of the work you're doing is, as you understand, it's to accumulate knowledge, to find out things. You're finding out a lot of things about how mice genome work. You're finding out a lot of things about the effects of genetic modification on mice, leaving a lot of mice casualties and bodies along the way. But you're not delivering for medical benefits. 0.004% of publications in high-ranking journals result in a new class of drugs that comes from basic research. So I would take issue, and so would leading authority figures, that your work is delivering for human medicine.
Adrian Stallwood from Animal Aid, can I put some of the conclusions, some of the suggestions from the ComRes poll that we commissioned this morning for our programme, which suggests that almost two-thirds of people don't think animal testing for medical research should be banned?
We've got to look at talking to people really about how the benefits are accruing for people and what the cost to the animals are. I think a more heartening fact is that 31% of people do want these experiments animals to be banned for medical research. You know, that's broadly in line with most polls, but at the end of the day, we recognise that medical research is a contentious issue, but we think once we get some of the facts and continue to put the facts into the public domain, and the longer patients and their relatives and their carers are exposed to disappointment after disappointment from drug after drug that works on animals and fails on people, that figure can only go up. It's only really possible to conclude that this stuff is justified if you're talking about a very, very twisted cost-benefit analysis. In other words, the benefits to people are, you know, really occasionally things come through, but most of the time they don't. But the cost to the animals is inordinately high. If you've got a very, very skewed cost-benefit analysis, clearly this stuff looks like it's ethical. But if you want to give the animals any kind of weight and not do them a great disservice, the benefits are really in the red in terms of animal suffering.
Okay, let me introduce some listeners, people who have been listening since 10 o'clock this morning. Angela Howard, her mother had Alzheimer's and she spent 4 years in a nursing home and died in June last year. Angela, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Andy is in Malden. Andy, hello to you.
Good morning.
Thanks for your... Is that Andy?
Yes, it is Andy.
Yeah, Andy, hello. Thanks for your patience. And Jared in Hexham. Hi, Jared.
Good morning. Hi.
Hi, and Ben is in Cardiff. Welcome to the programme, Ben.
Hello there.
And we've got Mary Stevenson, whose husband was diagnosed with Alzheimer's when he was 52. That was nearly 14 years ago. He's now in a residential home. Angela, what do you think of what you've heard this morning?
Well, I think it's really distressing to watch a parent deteriorate because of Alzheimer's. And there are 80,000 people in the UK at the moment with dementia, and Alzheimer's is a form of dementia. And there will be a million more in 2021. So listening to this programme, I wouldn't support unnecessary tests on animals. But because dementia and Alzheimer's is such a widespread problem and there is no cure for it as yet, I would support this animal experimentation, providing it was humane and helped to advance medicine.
From what you've heard this morning, and it is clearly a snapshot, and we've been able to see what we have been shown, does it sound humane and necessary to you?
I think it does sound humane. There are one or two concerns, but I was thinking that actually my mother these mice might have got better care than my mother did on her hospital ward. You talk about these wards for mice, but my mother did not get the right care and she had Alzheimer's. And I think this kind of experimentation and hopefully drugs to treat Alzheimer's will help better care for sufferers.
Jared in Hexham, you are actually a genetic scientist, I'm reading here, is that correct?
That is correct, yes.
What's your view about genetically modified mice and the benefits of using them in this kind of research?
Well, I mean, listening to those who advocate the use of GM mice, one would think there is a monopoly on human compassion on their side of things, and that's nonsense. There are many scientists, myself included, who disagree with the use of GM animals in research, not just for ethical reasons, but for scientific reasons as well. We don't want to get cancer and heart disease and diabetes. We don't want our families to get those diseases. We just think there's a better way to do that research. So the question is this the best science we can do? Or is there better science? And I'm afraid, in contrast to the speculative claims of those who do this GM mouse research we've heard from this morning, the evidence shows that it is not delivering, and even more than that, when you look into the real genetic nitty-gritty, that using animals, no matter how much you modify them, cannot deliver to human benefit, to cures and treatments for many diseases. And that's a fact.
What do you say about the glue ear progress that has been made?
Well, I think it's interesting. I mean, there have been a number of reviews in the scientific literature that criticise the use of GM animals, and one of them actually says the validity of using GM animals stems from anecdotes, such as the glue ear thing we've heard from this morning, which, by the way, hasn't resulted in any tangible human benefit. The validity stems from anecdotes and not from systematic examination in science. And there are many other quotes. One offers the lack of success is down to 65 million years of evolutionary distance between humans and mice. Other reviews claim that mice are lousy models for clinical studies and we need to put more emphasis on human studies, that the extent of the use of GM mice simply cannot be justified due to the real lack of success translating to human treatment, and that the actual benefits are rarely equivalent to the potential benefits that are claimed, and problems persist in extrapolating data to humans from GM animals. The evidence
so the gluey is with the gluey
those who
stuff?
Advocate other methods, not with those who advocate using GM mice.
Jared, the gluey stuff, I'll come back to it.
The gluey stuff, well, again, that's one small area. I would say even if that could be touted as a success, you would have to say, could that research have been done in any other way?
And
you
have Professor, to weigh it Professor Brown would
all of
like
the failures, and I'm afraid the failures are across the board. AIDS vaccines, cancer, stroke, diabetes, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's. There are many, many more failures than any successes.
I think this research couldn't have been done in other ways. And to take one of your points, Jared, the work that we do and the approaches that we use effectively are under the rigorous scrutiny of scientists all around the world. We wouldn't be funded to do this research unless it worked, unless we could put our work out in publications to scrutiny from scientists around the world, to other funding agencies who say, yes, this is the way forward to understand the relationship between genes and disease. And we are making those connections. Those are the important connections that we need to make if we're going to really be able to understand where the new treatments are coming from. Several of your several listeners and several commentators have made the point, quite rightly, that it's getting increasingly difficult to develop drugs for human diseases. We need better approaches. Being able to analyze the genome of the mouse and implicitly analyze the genome of a human by the way that we're carrying out experiments here is one of those routes. And it's certainly working for us, and certainly the scientific community around the world support us in that endeavor.
Jared, thank you very much for coming on the program. Let's hear from Mary and Andy and Ben. Mary, hello, go ahead.
Hello. Well, my husband was diagnosed with Alzheimer's 14 years ago, and to watch the degrading situation that he's now gone to, he has no quality of life at all. So, I mean, surely any research has got to give people who have loved ones with this disease some form of hope. I mean, after all, as a human being, we are the top of the food chain, I mean, a mouse's life or my husband's life, I'm sorry, that doesn't seem a contrast.
It doesn't give us the opportunity to abuse the rest of the animal chain, though. It's a very lazy way of doing things, I believe. Very lazy way. And hope isn't a really... It's awful that... the disease is awful, but hope is not a good enough excuse for abusing the animal chain.
I'm sorry,
chain
my
like
husband's life is more important than a mouse's. Than mice.
It's not one single mouse that we're comparing it to. It's the whole world's attitude to the way we mass produce food and the way we abuse animals.
You obviously haven't got anybody that you're close to with any of these diseases, unless you wouldn't
yes,
be able.
Yes, I have. Yes, I have. Yes, I have. And that's why I can make that statement. Human diseases are awful, but we can't just go ahead and abuse the rest of the animal kingdom as an excuse.
We're talking about mice here, Harwell. It's not the rest of the animal kingdom, and that's different.
No, but that's where you're wrong, because there are plenty of experiments that are going on monkeys, dogs, cats, and all sorts of things, and we're not hearing about this yet.
We're still at the top of the food chain, and I think a human life is...
Cure flu here.
A human life is more important than an animal's life. I'm sorry, but that is a...
Thank you, Mary, and Ben. Let me introduce Andy as well. Hi, Andy.
Hello, Victoria.
Yes.
Sorry, I've got a bit of a croaky voice, but I'll do my best. And coming from a position, I worked in the pharmaceutical industry for many years. Mm-hmm. And 30 to 40 years ago, I can assure you, although animal testing had to take place by law and we were as compassionate as we could be, the compassion and the care for those animals has moved on leaps and bounds in that 40 years, so we shouldn't ignore progress in that area. But what I would say to the gentlemen who object to animal testing is that the only way we're going to make any sort of progress is to investigate in depth how these things happen. I understand that mice aren't humans, but the only other option is to take a few humans and start treating them in the same way we treat mice. Well, you know, that got kicked out when the Nazis got defeated. So I don't... the only alternative is to not do any of this research. I heard the geneticists say there are other methods. Well, I'm not entirely sure what other methods there would be, for example, on Alzheimer's.
Well,
you
let's
sort of
ask.
Dig inside a human's brain, so where do you go?
Andy, thank you. Adrian Stallwood from Animal Aid, listening to you as you express your views this morning here on Five Live. In terms of the alternatives, what do you point to, Adrian?
I think I'd just like to come back to one of the points that was raised earlier, because it's a very, very important one. I've got the utmost sympathy for both the listeners that have phoned in with relatives with Alzheimer's. I'm a medical doctor as my other job, and I see Alzheimer's sufferers every day. I saw at least two or three cases of dementia yesterday in my emergency ward. It is not a trade-off between mice and people. We I've said before, and I'll say it again, objections to GM mouse experiments encompass human suffering as well as those of animals. The Alzheimer's created in mice is not Alzheimer's, it's Mouseheimer's. You can cure it hundreds of times over with different drugs in the lab. You test these drugs on people and they go on to fail. So it leads to ineffective drugs, disastrous clinical trials and dashed hopes of patients and their carers. So I'm a medical doctor and I see the havoc that dementia wrecks on people's lives. It is not a trade-off. There are better ways of doing things. So as to alternatives, there are a myriad alternatives and they're coming on all the time. We can talk about basic things like studying human populations. We can look at the human genome. In certain aspects, we can do genome-wide studies to have a look at causative, genes that may be implicated. And there's often multiple ones, as Professor Brown has mentioned earlier on. We can look at cell cultures. We can look at computer modelling. We can look at sophisticated new ways of trialing drugs with microdosing. We can look at microfluidics. We can look at organs on chips. There's many, many ways of doing things that are different. And quite frankly, the GM mouse system is like trying to use a bike to go to Mars. You know, it's not necessarily for us to say, you know, to build the rocket ship. But clearly, using the bike to try and get to Mars is a bad way and doesn't invalidate our objections to that in the first place.
Okay. Thank you very much for coming on the programme, Adrian. Adrian Stallwood from Animal Aid. Let me read some more text messages as we move now to a different area of the Merry Lion Centre. Mick in Chessington says, I used to be against animal testing, but one of my daughters was diagnosed with diabetes. Sadly, I would give 1,000 mice to cure her. Anne in Leicester says, without testing on mice, a cure for the syndrome, Rett syndrome, a devastating condition. A cure might be simply a dream, but as it is, a cure seems to be on the horizon. Barry in Streatham in London, Professor Brown uses doublespeak when he talks of causing pain and death as compassionate and mice as partners. The mice are force victims who are weak and defenceless. It's a totally power relationship, not partnership. It's not moral. Andrew in Cumbria, who says he's a scientist and believes passionately in the value of science research, says your programme today is very depressing. It's promoting the cruel exploitation of animals just so that people can eat masses of junk food and be as lazy as they like and not get diabetes, and so the drug companies can get rich. We already know how to solve type 2 diabetes. Eat a healthy, unprocessed diet and exercise. That from Andrew. If you want to text, it's 85058. You can also find me on Twitter, or you can call 0500 909 693. As I said earlier, the Merry Lion Centre is as big as a huge supermarket. We haven't quite yet got to the final ward that we're visiting today. This is the Ward 3, as it's known, the mutagenesis ward. Professor Steve Brown, mutagenesis. Quick explanation.
It's the way we target and change genes in mice to look at that relationship between genes and disease. So we can go in and make individual changes in a particular gene, which makes the technique so powerful. It can really dissect out that relationship between a gene and disease, which of course leads to potential new treatments.
And this is where some of the work on aging takes place. You may or may not know that animal research has ultimately led to vaccines for polio and TB, drugs like penicillin and Herceptin, and a number of drugs to help the symptoms of Alzheimer's, including Aricept, Exelon, Reminal and Ubixa. And Dr. Paul Potter is head of the ageing programme here. Hello, Dr. Potter, how are you?
Hi, I'm fine, thanks.
Thank you for having us in Ward 3, the mutagenesis ward. Tell us about the sort of work you do on age-related diseases.
Well, as you know from the news, ageing is a massive problem to society. To throw some figures out, the cost of osteoarthritis, say, to the NHS is about £900 million a year. There are 400 people a day being diagnosed with diabetes. and most of those diseases are associated with aging. So we're trying to investigate the interaction of genetic changes in an aging environment to ultimately understand more about the processes and eventually lead to cures, we hope.
And you use 18-month-old mice because effectively an 18-month-old mouse in human terms is an elderly person?
Yes, most inbred strains or mice strains vary in how long they live. The longest-lived mouse strain is about 8 years, but on average, most mouse strains live around 2 years. So we want to study the effect of genetic changes in a mouse that is old.
Right.
And 18 months is a reasonable time point before they start getting spontaneous aging phenotypes or
and
diseases.
Mouse strains, i.e. the mice that you keep here, because in the wild a mouse would live for, what, 3 months or something?
I don't know the figures, but the vast majority of mice are predated. You know, they don't live to old age. They are eaten by predators.
Sure. One study for the University of Toronto in 2010 concluded this. To date, animal models for both Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson's disease have failed to reflect many of the key aspects of the human diseases. Is that fair? Is that true?
To date, that may well be the case. Alzheimer's is not my specific area, but that's to date. That's we're continually working from that information. We learn and progress.
So you say, look, even if that's true to date, it doesn't mean we stop now.
Well, yeah. What else are we supposed to do? Just give up? How will that help society? Every animal model that's identified, every publication that comes out, we learn something. That's the reason for doing it. It's not all about just developing a therapy. It's about fundamental, basic scientific understanding.
But mice wouldn't naturally get Alzheimer's. The mice get Alzheimer's because you have effectively genetically engineered them to have it. Does that mean any of your results are questionable? I mean, how much credibility is there if you draw any results from the experiments here?
We factor that in. We appreciate mice aren't people, but these studies are very, very difficult in people. The problem with humans is they're very, very complicated. The only person that is the same as you is you. There is nobody else the same. Patients don't all get the same disease. They have many, many genes that influence those diseases. And we need it's a complex study to do in humans. It is useful. We do get information, and we do relate all our changes back to all our findings back to humans.
Okay. Right, we're going to have a look at the startle test now, which means moving again from Ward 3. Thank you very much. I don't know if you want to come with us, Dr. Potter. It's entirely up to you. We're going to have a look at the startle test, which is in opposite Ward 3. And this is where mice are put into a transparent cylinder, into a box, which is effectively a large door, a huge sort of, I don't know what you want to call it. If I say microwave, it gives the wrong impression. Basically, you open a door, and inside you've got the same size as microwaves, but what actually are they, Professor Brown?
So what we're testing here with the mice is their response to loud noises. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a very interesting phenomenon. If we slammed a door, create a very loud noise, you'd jump. You'd have a startle response. That's a normal response for all mammals. If you precede that by another loud noise, your startle to the door slamming is diminished.
Yes.
This is what's called pre-pulse inhibition. In fact, we know from human studies that in schizophrenics, they have very poor pre-pulse inhibition. So we're actually looking for mouse models, GM mice, that in fact show poor pre-pulse inhibition, because finding the genes that cause that might tell us something about the genetics of schizophrenia.
Okay.
So we're testing the startle response, the pre-pulse inhibition response in mice in these boxes. It's a very simple, non-invasive test. We put the mice sit on a pad. It's an accelerometer. It tells us whether the mice are jumping or not, that they show the startle response. We play a loud noise, and we see whether they startle, and then we take them out again and return them to their cage.
Okay. So what are you holding in your hand is what you put the mice in. Just describe that for our listeners.
Right. It's a little tube in which the mice will sit during the protocol. So it's a very short protocol, relatively straightforward. They'll be sitting in there. And effectively, it's the kind of test that you would also perhaps test
humans with to look at their startle response as well.
Why don't you just test humans then?
Well, because of what Paul and others have already mentioning, we can't really dissect out the genetics in the human population. We can't make that easy correlation between changing one gene and what's happening. If we could change genes in humans and do it in an easy way, we'd do that. But we have to do it in mice to make that relationship. And then, of course, we can take that relationship into understanding how we get these changes in the human population and what diseases they're associated with, such as behavioral disease, such as schizophrenia, and whether we can get real insights into the genes that are involved with diseases such as schizophrenia.
Presumably, though, every time a mouse jumps in this startle test, it's because it's alarmed, distressed, whatever word you want to use, by the noise that it's hearing. Schizophrenia is distressing enough in humans, so equally a mouse with schizophrenia would be distressed too.
I don't think we're making a mouse with schizophrenia. In fact, I don't think you could. I'm sure many of our listeners would agree with me. You can't make a mouse with schizophrenia with all of the other behavioral symptoms. But what, of course, we're testing, I think, is a very non-invasive test. This is the kind of test, as I indicate, I think a very good analogy is the door slamming startles us. I don't think that's too invasive a test for the mouse. It's a relatively straightforward test, and it provides us with an enormous amount of information about the behaviour of that mouse and what's going wrong with it.
There have been studies, including at King's College Hospital in London, which measured a group of human volunteers and how startled they were with a noise of 116 decibels, which is, I'm told, similar to sitting at the front row of a gig. And in a US study, the startle reflex of humans with and without schizophrenia were compared by measuring their eye blink reflexes in response to noise. Again, bearing in mind the sort of complications of human beings, is that not something that you could use humans for instead of mice?
I come back to the basic point, which is we can't use humans because we can't make that easy relationship between altering a particular gene and seeing what the outcome is. In fact, we as you know, here in our mouse clinic, we're looking at all sorts of different aspects of disease and testing individual mice in a very controlled setting. One of the members of the Mary Lann Center said early on, we can control diet, we can control the environment, to really find out the relationship between gene and disease in a way that we can't easily do in the enormously heterogeneous human population.
Okay, let me read some more messages from listeners. Victoria, I thought I'd listen to see if the show would help me change my mind. It hasn't. I don't agree. The techs and the director are coming over all jolly, and they say how they care about the mice. It's like they have been told to be like this in a meeting beforehand. We won't get a true picture, not when they have a fancy name for breaking their necks. That's Helen in Clifton. This from Jay. My two parents have dementia and Parkinson's. The last 6 years have been hard seeing your parents deteriorate. There's also a financial burden that will affect us all. I wouldn't wish my situation on anyone. Keep testing. It's as essential as finding new fuels stroke foods. Molly in Coventry says they rarely find cures for these diseases. How long have they been working on cancer research, for example? And this from one listener who doesn't leave their name. Your discussion with the laboratory technicians and scientists is informative and honest. They and the lab staff clearly care deeply about the animals. These animals are a vital part of research into diseases that cause so much distress to so many people. I'm going to introduce you now at 11:52 to Amanda Pickard. She's the manager of the Frozen Embryo and Sperm Archive here at the International Centre for Mouse Genetics at the Mary Lann Center in Oxford. Amanda, hello, welcome to the programme.
Hello.
Now, the reason we want to talk to you is because the mouse models that are created here by the scientists can be used in laboratories all over the world. You store them here, it's an archive, it's like a library, and you can send them all over the world. Sometimes you sell them, depending on who wants it. Sometimes it's in a sort of not-for-profit arrangement. You might charge them postage and packaging. But how many models do you have here?
Well, in our archive, frozen as embryos, we have something in the order of 1,500 different models available. These are mice that have been created here and at other research research establishments, and we offer a free archiving service to other establishments. And we protect them. It's an insurance policy. If something catastrophic happens, then we can recover live animals from frozen embryos. And it means also that we don't have to recreate those animals if somebody wants to go on and study that particular gene.
And presumably also, in terms of transporting, you're not transporting live animals, you're transporting the frozen embryos.
Wherever possible, we will transport frozen embryos and send those to the recipient. It's obviously far cheaper and there's a massive welfare benefit. But not every lab has the ability to handle frozen embryos, so there are circumstances where we would have to recreate live animals here and send out live animals.
And these are stored in big tanks. People will have seen this kind of stuff on films, on TV programmes. Big tanks, and you pull out a tube, a straw, effectively, and the liquid nitrogen fumes bubble over, because obviously that keeps it cool. What sort of temperature are they stored at?
They're stored at close to minus 200 degrees C. So it's the samples are stored in liquid nitrogen. They're safe there for around 40 years or more. We actually believe them to be safe indefinitely. We did some very early trials 40 years ago, which showed that the background radiation that the embryos would be exposed to means there's no adverse effect on them as samples, and we know we can recover lines that were archived 40 years ago and recreate live mice. That's a massive cost benefit, because we don't then have to go through the welfare aspects of recreating those models back from the beginning again.
And so who would you sell your embryos to? What sort of companies?
The embryos are passed mostly to academic research organisations, so it's mostly to scientists in universities or other research labs. We do sell them to commercial organisations if there is if they can meet agreement with our material transfer agreements. So there are licenses. Not the money,
no,
the licenses,
the
investment, protecting the investment in actually creating those models.
So if GlaxoSmithKline, for example, wanted one of your particular mouse models that was frozen in your archive, what kind of negotiations, what would they be like?
Well, many of our mouse models in the archive were actually paid for by GlaxoSmithKline, so we would be able to release them to them directly. Others which have been paid for by other funding sources, then they would need to agree to put the licenses in place for those lines as well.
Professor Brown, why would GlaxoSmithKline be paying you to develop certain mouse models?
Because they, like many other pharmaceutical companies, realise that learning about genes is critical for developing the drugs of the future. So in the past, they've invested in this research here. I'm sure other companies will invest in the future, because it is one of the routes that we need to explore to have that real understanding, that real expectation that we can develop new drugs in the future and that they'll work.
Do you test drugs here?
No, we don't test drugs here. That's partly because it's just not part of our remit within the Medical Research Council. But clearly we have many interesting models here that are telling us about potential new therapies. And they're going to be one of the ways that we can actually assess new drugs in the future as we develop these new
drugs. Do you test existing drugs on some of your mouse models here?
We do. For example, in glue ear, because we now understand the molecular mechanisms of what's going wrong, we've been taking drugs that already exist and are on the market. It's called repurposing drugs, and using them to actually damp down the middle ear glue and inflammation. We've shown that very effectively, and that just shows that the hypotheses we had about how the glue ear is developing is actually right. And of course, this immediately provides us a possibility for bringing this as a new treatment into the human population.
As soon as you tell people, as soon as people hear that, for example, a pharmaceutical company has invested or paid for you to come up with a certain mouse model, people see a sort of, puppet master and sinister motives.
We're nobody's puppet. We're funded by the Medical Research Council and by the government. We choose which research to do, and we choose who to partner with.
Right. So if a drugs company said to you, look, we'd like you to invest in the Mary Lyon Centre, and we want you to look at this particular mouse model, you make the final decision?
It has to be
science. But money talks, come on.
No, it has to be science that we're interested in, that we think will work and will have benefits for human healthcare. Money doesn't talk.
Seriously?
Seriously.
Okay. All right. So what motivates you, Professor Brown? What gets you up in the morning? What is it that excites you about this place?
Well, we've talked about it. Glue ear sort of gets me up in the morning. But
It's about actually discovering new ways in which a mammal, be it a mouse or a human, is working. That's what science is about. It's about finding knowledge out there about the way the world works, in this case, the mouse or human. And then the excitement of being able to translate that knowledge into potential new therapies to make a difference. To make a difference for healthcare, to make a difference for children, for adults with dementia that we heard about today. That's what gets me up in the morning.
Got a couple of minutes before Sheila's here on Five Live. Let's have a very quick word with Ian in Nottinghamshire, who's been listening, and also Pauline. Good morning to you both. Go ahead, Ian. I haven't left you a great deal of time, but go ahead.
No, just totally against it. I listened to the show only. I found it difficult listening today. I listened only to see if I would change my mind, but I'm surrounded here by four rescue cats. That probably tells you a bit about me. I think it's more about money than anything else, and I think humans have become too self-important. I don't see why these creatures should be tortured, and that's how I see it. I've not changed my mind at all.
Ian, thank you very much. Hello, Pauline, go ahead.
Hi, morning. Yes, I have a daughter with cystic fibrosis. I also have dogs, cats, hamsters, and in a heartbeat, I would test them to get my child a cure. When you watch a child growing up, can't get their breath, now she's been inflicted with diabetes as well, I would do absolutely anything in my power. And if anybody, animal rights, says that they wouldn't do this for their child, I don't believe them.
Thank you very much, Pauline. Ian, thank you as well. Professor Brown, thank you for having us at the Mary Lyon Centre today.
Thank you for coming.
Amanda, thanks for your time as well, and thanks to all the staff here.
On digital and online.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
bbc.co.uk/5live.